Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 31 of season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me for today's episode, and hopefully all week, is Hal Bryan of the Rocketeer Minute, of the October Sky Minute, a few other things also. Welcome back to the show, Hal.
Well, thanks, Rob. It's fun to be back with you and looking forward to talking about a new movie. This is as we were saying just before we started, this film is a great choice.
Well, okay, so why don't we just start from there? Do you remember when you first saw this, why you like it? Anything you want to say about the movie Saving Private Ryan, about your history with the movie?
So I saw it in the theater when it first came out. At that, I can't swear by this at that time of my life. It was opening day. When a movie like that grabbed my attention, especially in that era of my life, we tended just to be there, you know, opening Friday. And you know, what can you say about it? I mean, I've been, a student of history my whole life, and I celebrate anything that looks at various periods in our history and brings them forward and gets new eyes on them and takes them seriously. And that's so much of what this film did and continues to do is, even though it's not in and of itself a true story, it takes the types of people and the sacrifices they were making back then and the challenges that they were facing and reminds people that they were real. They're not just pages in a book.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah, I mean, as anyone listening to this, and you also, you know that I love this movie, and that's one of the reasons why I chose it. And it's because of that. It's the idea of taking, making a fictional story out of something historic and making it so emotional and realistic that if you didn't know better, you would believe that it really did happen. It brings up so many questions about the idea of war and what is done during war, whether it should or shouldn't be. You can debate many of these issues for hours.
Sure, and it's great to see. I know later this week, if you decide to continue to have me on all week, we're going to be talking about some other World War
II. That's up to you, not me.
Okay, well then, I think it's a given. So I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole. But by the time this movie came out, we'd gotten to the point where we can show, more grit and more emotional depth. It's not just, a square jawed hero blasting his Tommy gun and, blowing away all the Nazis and everything else, that it's a bunch of guys that are human. And as you just said, some of them, some of the good guys in this movie make decisions that make us feel kind of uncomfortable now, but it's good to be able to look at that and say, once again, there were real people. There were real young people back there faced with this horror and faced with impossible decisions. And, at the end of the day, all they could do was, do was their best. And it's nice to see that, you could take a movie like this that is more nuanced than, say, something you would have seen 50 years earlier, has a little bit more depth, shows some more flaws, even in the heroes, and still come out of it, or I should say, come out of it with an even greater appreciation for the sacrifices that were made back then and those giants, on whose shoulders we stand.
Right, for sure. No question about that. All right, so minute 31 begins with Sanders finishing his thought and ends with dishes getting clean. So, I mean, we ended things on Friday. We had We started with some of the bureaucracy, I guess you could say, for lack of a better term, of this part of the movie. We had the secretaries with the letters, and then the main secretary, I guess, bringing or main writer, the typewriter. I don't even know what you would call what her position was.
Yeah, I mean, I thought of her as maybe a stenographer. It might be the might have
I'm
been
trying to remember. I'm
a
trying to remember
title.
what she's referred to as in the. She's known as the War Department clerk. There you go.
A clerk. Okay,
There you
fair
go.
enough.
The War Department clerk. Yes. So, she went to her immediate superior, and then the two of them went to the next superior above them, and then the two officers then left and went to a third officer. So we've now gone through three ranks. We went to the lieutenant, and then the captain, and then the colonel.
Right.
Both the captain and the colonel, we mentioned this last week, are played by actors that are quite well known. The captain, Captain Sanders, is David Wohl, and they go to Colonel Bryce, played by Bryan Cranston, who we talked also about the fact that it was quite accurate, the fact that they decided to take a make a character who's a wounded soldier, a wounded officer, and give him this type of job, because it was something that they did quite often in the War Department, that there were officers that were wounded that were eventually given jobs in the administration afterwards, stuff like that, in order to continue with the type of work that they were doing and stuff like that. Friday we talked about two of the brothers, the one who died on Omaha Beach and the one who died on Utah. Utah is Peter Bryan. That's the second one. The first one was, you have Sean Ryan that died on the Omaha Beach, and then Peter Ryan who died on Utah Beach. And then they're continuing, and he said, and he hands him another piece of paper. Sanders hands Bryce another piece of paper and says, and this man was killed last week in New Guinea. And he looks at it and he goes, Daniel Ryan. So, I mean, it's, first of all, in my opinion, it's very effective that here they've given us the names of three of the brothers, one after the other, just but done in a very succinct way. You don't have to get into a long story that there are three brothers and this is this name and this is that name, and this, they even tell us what happened to each of them.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's very efficient writing. It's a really powerful bit of exposition that just lays out the whole thing without taking up much time at all. And by this point in the film, you understand enough about particularly Utah Beach and Omaha Beach. We were just there in the in the movie, and it's no wonder. We're not at all surprised to find that that two brothers who happen to be part of that large operation, could easily have been lost.
Exactly. Now, I mean, we talked a lot about this earlier in the season about Omaha Beach, but we didn't talk about Utah Beach. Do you know how many casualties there were on the Allies side at Utah Beach?
I don't. No, it's I. I mean, I could be glib and say too many, but it was. I know it was horrific.
Yeah, I mean, again, Omaha Beach was the worst, but on Utah there was 197 that were killed from the 4th Infantry Division, and then the airborne soldiers that were fighting there also, they lost about 2,500.
Wow.
So yeah, I mean, these are pretty big numbers with the whole thing. 4th Infantry didn't meet all of their objectives that they were supposed to, because they landed too far south, and the airborne troops that showed up by parachute or glider weren't able to help them to do all of everything that they wanted to do on Utah Beach. I mean, again, it's really interesting looking back at the history, and that you can see what happened, what were the goals of each of the beaches, and whether they were able to get them done and stuff like that. But in the overall picture, we know that they were able. I mean, the D-Day landings at Normandy was a huge success. Obviously, there were a lot of casualties, but they were able to to break through the German lines, and that's what they needed to do there. You know, if they had failed there, that would have been it. You know, I don't know what they would have. I don't know what the next attempt would have been for them to try and do something like this.
Right, and you have to wonder too if the Allies had failed there. And the Germans were somehow able to sort of retrench and build up. Would they have then gone ahead, you know, with something they were planning years earlier and invaded England?
Right.
And if they'd ever, you know, it's hard to imagine that. And of course, you know, when we look back, we talk about history. It's so easy to fall into that trap and kind of dismiss any other possibilities because we know what actually happened. From our perspective, it's all a foregone conclusion. But
yeah.
Of course, at the time, you know, there was the farthest thing from it, and you do wonder, you know, if D-Day had failed, I don't know that the Germans would have been in any position realistically to then consider, continuing to press. To press further west, even and come across the channel, but somehow, if they had, and if they had succeeded in taking England, I think we would have been looking at a decades long Cold War between, you know, the Allies and the Third Reich.
Yeah, that's very possible. Again, there are so many you know, movies and books and stories that have taken that to other. You know, to other levels by looking at alternative, you know, histories and stuff like that. So we're not going to go there because there's really no reason for us to do that. You know, again, there's no way of knowing what really would have happened. But you know, as you said, we look at history from the perspective of what actually did happen, not the what ofs, not the what ifs or anything like that. Here, they were able to do it. You know, they made it through and. You know, we're able to with the help of Miller and his men, you know, to break right. through.
Amen to that.
Exactly. So it's very interesting. They mentioned that you know, Daniel Ryan was killed in New Guinea, right? So it got me thinking. I was like, okay, what was happening on the Pacific front at this time? Because I mean, we know what day this was. This was, you know. You know, right now it's June 9th.
Sure.
That this is all being taken care of. So it obviously means that something happened at the beginning of June in New Guinea, where, you know, Daniel Ryan must have been a part of the you know, of the attack, I guess you can say. So I actually, you know, looked into all the various battles of the New Guinea. I mean, the fight in New Guinea, the New Guinea campaign. Went from January 1942 to August 45. I mean, that's a very, right. very long time with a whole bunch of, you know, a whole bunch of different battles going on and stuff like that. But I wanted to try and figure out what was going on in the beginning of June 1944.
I know the Allies had made, you know, multiple incursions into New Guinea earlier in 44, mm-hmm. but as far as right in June, I couldn't tell you exactly what was happening.
Right. So they had the Western New Guinea campaign that began in April of 1944, and that went to the end of the war till August 15th, 1945. And during that whole campaign, I mean, there were, The Allies lost nearly 2,000 men and another 8,000 that were wounded during this. I mean, I'm assuming you like me love this type of stuff. So I'm assuming you've seen the Pacific.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Absolutely. So, I mean, the Pacific shows the type of situations that they all needed to deal with at you know, on the Pacific front, you know, during the war. And stuff like that. So we had the New Guinea campaign, and then there was the Battle of Biak, B-I-A-K, that ran from the 27th of May to the 17th of August, 1944. So based on my research, and again, I have no proof of this. My assumption is that Daniel Ryan was fighting in that battle. I mean, they sent 12,000 U.S. Soldiers there, and they lost 438 that were killed. along with another almost 2,400 that were wounded through the whole thing. For their, you know, from the ground, from the ground forces that were there. So it's a small island in New Guinea called Biak, which is in the Gilvink Bay. Right now, that's part of Indonesia. It was part of MacArthur's offensive to try to clear New Guinea in order for them to eventually, you know, make an invasion on the Philippines. And the objective of the Allies was to basically capture the island and then construct airfields. And they were able to then use that island as a base in order to send, you know, to have planes stop there on the way and get refueled and whatever they needed to do. So again, it's pretty amazing when you just look at the all the puzzle pieces of everything that happened, you know, during World War II. Even if you're just looking at the Pacific, you know, everything was planned out that we need this island, we need that island, and once we get this one, we can move on to the next one and move on to the next one and things like that.
So it's right, and amazing, mind-boggling too, to just to think about, you know, the scale of it, and you know, these opposite sides of the world, and you know, all the different allied countries in particular coming together. And it's astounding when you think about what the state of things like communications were back right. then. You know, right. we are so spoiled now with the computers in our pockets, and we're reachable anywhere and everywhere. And if you want photos and video, we can send that too. If you want an aerial photo, anybody can throw a drone up in the air and all this sort of stuff. And you know, back then we're talking telegrams and letters and, you know, sketchy radio traffic and things like that. And to be able to coordinate these, you know, vastly different campaigns with all these different requirements and different environments and everything. It's one of those parts of history that just gets bigger and more mind-boggling the more you learn about it.
Yeah, for sure. There's also another battle that happened around the same time called the Battle of Lone Tree Hill, which was fought between 17th of May and the 2nd of September 1944. And that one, it was a major battle in Dutch New Guinea between the U.S. and Japanese forces. And there the Allies lost 400 and the Japanese had almost 4,000 dead. Actually, almost 4,000 dead, not including all of those that died of sickness and starvation during this time for the Japanese soldiers. I mean, it's again, some of these numbers are just completely crazy to think about. So right. again, it's possible that it could, you know, there's no way of knowing which of these two, Daniel Ryan, the fictional Daniel Ryan died from. I guess it was easier for them. At least they did a little bit of research and they knew that there was a battle going on in New Guinea at that time. You know, for sure. You know, instead of them just saying in the Pacific, you know, yeah, he was in the Pacific, you know. And you know, the way that they do this scene is just great because you can hear the music going in the background over everything that's going on. You know, trying to be as somber as possible while they're, you know, relaying this information to Colonel Bryce, you know, letting him know that this is the story of what we have to deal with. These are the three men. And he goes, the three men are brothers, sir. I've just learned that this afternoon, their mother is going to get all three telegrams. That's not all. There's a fourth brother, the youngest. He parachuted in with the 101st Airborne night before the invasion. He's somewhere in Normandy. We just don't know where. Is he alive? We don't know. And then Bryce turns to him and says, okay, come with me. So again, it's a very succinct minute showing us the idea of the chain of command. You know, that, you know, we talked about this before. that, you know, you have first the clerk who goes to the lieutenant, who goes to the captain, who goes to the colonel, and the colonel now is going to be going to the general, you know, that type of thing. And it's a clever way to tell us what's going on here. Also by showing us that, you know, sometimes bureaucracy can be helpful and sometimes it can be hindrance.
Yeah, exactly. And in this case, there's this big injection of humanity into the whole thing.
Correct.
You know, one of the overarching, you know, motifs in the war itself is that nothing else matters. Everybody's got to sacrifice. Everybody's got to drop what you're doing because the world is at war, and you know, we simply have to win. And the idea that you know, getting the last surviving Ryan brother, finding him, taking him home, is a morally and ethically just thing to do, and it's a very, you know, it's a very rewarding thing to do. It is the right thing to do, but it will not help us win the war. And right. Arguably the resources spent, you know, could be a hindrance in the whole thing. And what fascinates me about the film overall and you know, the way this, the episodes or the segments we're talking about this week all build up is that it's still, to me, 100% believable that something like this, you know, could have happened. We would have looked at this and said, you know, yes, we're at war, and yes, that's the only thing that matters, but come on, you know, we can't do this to this family. And it's a wonderful, just a wonderful injection of humanity and an acknowledgement of maybe not now, but someday there will be more to the world than just the war.
Right. And we, yeah, again, we're going to talk about this whole week about how that plays out. But yes, I mean, that's completely, you know, it's an interesting way of telling this story. You know, we had the first 25 minutes of this movie was the, you know, the battle on the beach. And then, you know, we see the battle of the beach ends, and then they bring us here, you know, in order to say, okay, you know, now we're going to go to the bureaucrats in the military, and we're going to see something else that's going on. You know, is it something that's going to be helpful? I don't know. We'll have to wait and see, you know, that type of thing. And I like the way that they do that, because they also show us that due to the way that things work in the army, you know, you don't do these things on your own. You know, you're there, you're
right.
You know, you follow the orders and where the order is coming from. And, you know, we talked a little bit about this at the end of last week. You know, you got to give a lot of credit to that female clerk who remembered that there are three, you know, that there are names that are similar, you know, and like, wait a second. Cause think about the thousands of letters that they were writing, you know, let's say on a weekly basis, probably even more than that. But, you know, for her to say, oh, wait a second, there was another Ryan over there. Let me just go check. And a second, it is somehow connected.
Right. Well, I think she would have clued in on the fact that all these letters are going to the same address and the same recipient, and that would have stuck out in her mind. But
no, but yeah, she wasn't necessarily the one who was typing them up. You know, that's the thing.
Oh, true. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, and it wasn't one after the other. That's the craziest thing about it. You know, here we're talking about something that let's say that they're a few hours apart or whatever it is. But for the manager to say, oh, wait a second, I remember that name. And something, I think it said Peyton, Iowa. I think it's the name of the town. And I'm like, whoa. It's like, you got to give her a lot of credit for that.
Right.
You know, for figuring out how to do that. So, yeah, I like that. I like the way that they present that here. They decide to give us a quick little shot of something else. You know, we get you know, a car that starts driving up I wouldn't necessarily say a deserted road, but a road that doesn't have very many people driving. There's no one else driving on it. It's like moving up to a farmhouse, and the music continues here. Now, I love this music. I mean, we're not going to, I know later today our segment will be about music, so maybe you'll have something to say about that there. But I just love the way that this music is very somber music that fits in every situation that they, you know, throughout this movie, you know, about how they use it all the way across, you know, that type of thing. And, you know, we get like a view of the farmhouse from afar. And then we see a car that has an army emblem on it go towards it, and then it's great because we get an inside shot in the house of a woman who is clearing dishes. Now I noticed something very interesting about the dishes that she's clearing. Did you notice anything strange about them? Or I don't know if you want to use the word strange. Did you notice anything indicative of what she's doing?
Let me scrub through that minute again. I mean, it looks like
it's at 50. It's at second 56. You can see it.
Okay, so 54, 56. So it looks like to me either tea or coffee, and there's sets of silverware. I mean, it looks like service for two, to me.
Okay. You're on the right track.
Okay, so there's two. Tea or coffee cups, a bowl, and let me get a little bit bigger here. Okay, and these are dirty dishes, right? Putting things away. Maybe I need another hint here.
No. You were already on the right track. It's a service for two. Now, what is that telling us?
That is it. Somebody else has been there. I mean, I always sort of presumed. I can't recall. Do we know about the dad at this point?
Yeah, we don't know anything about the dad, but the assumption is that there's a father also. Okay, so
sure.
So my point that I'm trying to make here is that this is they don't have any other kids. They don't have any daughters. You know, this is a family that has four sons, and all four of their sons are not here, and. You know, the father and mother are having afternoon, you know, tea or cake or whatever it is. Their life is still going on. But, you know, we can see that you know, they're the only two people that are in this farmhouse.
Right.
Even though throughout the movie, I mean, the spoiler for anyone who hasn't, you know, paid enough attention, the father is never mentioned, never shown or anything like that.
Yeah, I didn't think that was the case, but I was trying to remember.
Right, but the question then remains, you know, the quote from earlier today that Captain Sanders said was it says their mother is going to be getting all three telegrams. Okay, that actually does make it sound as if there is no father, because they would say the parents are getting the letter.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, otherwise. And I never gave it a ton of thought when they say the mother is getting the telegram.
Well, that you don't do that when you're watching a movie normally. Only when you go into it, you know,
minute by minute.
That's right.
Yeah.
So you know, whatever I, for me,
if I thought about
it's a little
it,
strange that you know. So it does then ask the question, you know, who is. The who is eating with Mrs. Ryan? You know, maybe she's had a friend over. It could be also, but
and it could be, you know, Dad could have a job in the war, supporting the war effort at some level too. He's not likely to be deployed just given his presumptive age, but who knows? But yeah, could be a neighbor or. Could just be Dad and we don't see him. And you know, certainly at that time, when we talk about, well, his mom's getting the bad news, it's the conventions of the day would say that that the assumption would be that mother would be hit harder than father emotionally.
Okay, for sure.
And I'm not saying that that's valid or that really would have been the case, but, you know, in the 40s with sort of a different time and different roles and things like that. So, but it's interesting. Now you've got me really wondering what's dad up to this whole time.
That's right. Again, my assumption based on the clues that we have here is that there is no father, because they would have said his parents were going to get the letter. That's what they would have said. But again, we're never going to get any real hint to the truth about it. Later on when we do meet Ryan, he doesn't mention the fact that, my father did this and my father did that, you know?
Right.
So there's really no way of knowing, but it's just very, it's a seeming contradiction here, you know, with the fact that, again, obviously Mrs. Ryan can have tea with anyone she wants. You know, I don't have a problem with that. I'm not saying that, but so yeah, I just thought it was interesting that we actually, you know, that they took the time to, when they were filming the scene, to say, okay, we're just gonna have two people here.
Right.
Because, I mean, a little spoiler for later in the week. I mean, we don't see a husband run out to help her or anything like that. So, right. And then the minute ends with a great shot where she's standing by the window, obscured by the curtains, starting to wash dishes. But you can see this car in the distance from the top half of the window, you know, coming towards the farm. So I like that shot.
Yeah.
I think it's a great shot.
Yeah, and it makes me curious about where they shot it, because it's a pretty high vantage point. And there's some somewhat hilly areas in Iowa, but I wonder if this was shot somewhere else where you had, you know, that exaggerated, not exaggerated, but that sort of extra elevated terrain. That's it.
Right.
But it is, yeah, it's beautifully, beautifully framed. You can see so much of the driveway and the cars coming in from the top left corner and just coming right on down. And it's obvious it's, you know, even way off in the distance, it's obvious it's not going somewhere else. You know, this is coming up her lane.
Right. Exactly. And that's the way this minute ends. So did you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
I don't think so. I think, it's powerful. I don't think there's a little bit to talk about with another element in her home, but I think we see that probably tomorrow's
episode. Yeah, tomorrow we will see some other interesting things in the home that I've never noticed before. And, doing it this way will give us a little bit of a more insight into things.
Sure.
All right. Excellent. So every Monday we have a segment called Maestro Monday, where my guests will give their top five John Williams movie scores. So why don't you start off with your number five and work your way up?
All right. So, and I have two honorable mention, but I'll save those to the end. Number five for me is Jurassic Park. Number four, Empire of the Sun, which is one I don't know if it gets maybe as much attention as some of the blockbusters.
Okay.
The next one was, it was almost a two-way tie for second place. But next for me is Superman. There's something just so perfectly triumphant about it. And then number two, so Raiders of the Lost Ark, or you could expand that across at least the original Indiana Jones trilogy. And speaking of trilogies, number one, it simply has to be, you know, the original Star Wars, and of course carrying into the trilogy and a few of the subsequent things. But you know, that film made me love big symphonic scores when I was 9 years old. And, you know, John Williams made me love classical music and Bugs Bunny made me love opera. So that's how I got here. My honorable mentions, and these were tough, but it's just not to include, but I got myself thinking about, you know, scores that I would love to listen to versus scores that I think are incredibly well done and iconic and everything else. So I've got to include Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Jaws. Those are some of the most, you know, incredibly effective bits of music. And they, you know, were within a hair's breadth of making that top five. This was a tough choice.
Yeah. Again, I mean, John Williams has a very, very long filmography that surpasses probably every other, every other composer of movies up until, you know, in history. And he has more hits than any of those people, or let's say more recognizable themes, you know, from that sure. perspective.
Yeah, there's some gifted and very, very prolific composers out there. You know, Mark Isham, James Horner, Jerry Goldsmith, a lot of incredible talent. But Williams is in this interesting category on his own. A childhood friend of mine, Tom Geyer, who does the theme music for the podcast that my friend Jim O'Kane and I do, had written some, he works in movie scores and things, and he'd written some placeholder stuff for an early teaser trailer for one of the Harry Potter films. And that's part of his business. He builds up a music library, and when they need to do an early trailer and they haven't done the score and the soundtrack yet, they will go to his library or work with him directly to come up with something that'll sort of fit the mood. And as it turned out, I hate that I can't think of which Harry Potter film it was, but as it turned out, John Williams heard the stuff that my friend did and really liked it, and with his permission incorporated it into the score. And so my friend got to be there in the room and work with Williams and weave this theme into the overall score, and then be there when Williams conducted the orchestra to record it. And that was, I can't think of a bigger bucket list item for somebody who's in that business. And I was 10% jealous and 110% overwhelmingly happy for him.
It's true.
So,
okay, that makes sense. All right. So, Hal, would you like to tell people where they can find Hal Bryan?
Sure. Well, I'm in a few places out there. We mentioned in the intro a couple of Movie of My Minute podcasts that I've been involved with, the Rocketeer Minute. Which has ostensibly completed its run, but the whole archive is out there, and we do have some ideas for some special episodes that we want to revisit. So there may be some more coming there one of these days. And then as we're recording this, we're in the very closing stretch of finishing the October Sky Minute. So by the time this episode airs, actually, I think the October Sky Minute should be done or within an episode or two. So you can certainly find both of those, RocketeerMinute.com, OctoberSkyMinute.com, or wherever you get podcasts. I frequently co-host another podcast with my employer, EAA, the Experimental Aircraft Association, and that one's called The Green Dot, or EAA's The Green Dot, and you can find that one all the places you get podcasts. And otherwise, I'm out there on all the social media channels under my real name, Hal Bryan. So if anybody ever wants to say hello or connect, send me a note.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this.
Solitude, you. Bye.